One guy hand-painted t-shirts with popular logos like Puma and Nike with the swish. One said Reebok. I now knew that spelling was incorrect, thanks to Caitlin. Whenever I was wearing my shirt, I avoided going by his stand. I did not want to be bad for business. I spotted the bracelet one weekend. It was made from wood and had a small cheetah print pattern burnt into it. It was lovely and reasonably priced, so I bought it hoping it would keep her happy until I could find a way to get my photo taken. 5th November, 1998. Dear Caitlin, hello, how are you? It was so nice to hear from you. Thank you very much for the Nike shirt. I love it. Now I have two of the competitive modern fashions, Nike and Reebok. Thank you. My parents also thank you for the present. The pictures are brilliant. I was glad to know your lovely family, nice big house and beautiful vehicles. Caitlin, I have to tell you what I feel. You are becoming more and more beautiful and lovely. Keep it up. I have enclosed an African bangle. You wear it on the wrist. I hope you will like it. In my next letter, I am going to give you something bigger and more beautiful. At our school, we wear uniforms so our parents do not bother buying us as many clothes as you have. You are lucky. Did you hear the new hit from the Spice Girls? Viva Forever? I love it. Do you? We are in summer and it's very hot. We even sweat at night. Are you also in summer? Caitlin, thank you again for the nice shirt, best pencils, lovely pictures, and the nice postcard. Thank you. Lots of love, Martin Gander, BF4E. A few weeks later, my father arrived home in a jovial mood. Martin, his deep baritone funneled through our doorway. I was inside studying for my Form 2 finals that would take place that December. That January, I would begin Form 3, which meant I had 2 more years before I could go on for my A-levels, the last 2 years before university. My goal was to stay number 1 in my class, so I would be eligible for a scholarship at the University of Zimbabwe. That meant doing well in all my subjects. Math, pure science, history, geography, and English were easy. I didn't worry about accounting. I had 100 average in that class. Shona and woodworking were the problem. Both were also required classes and my least favorite. That evening, I was working on Shona verb conjugations when my father arrived with news. "What is it, Baba?" I asked, ducking out from our house into the courtyard. "A photographer will come this weekend," he said. "It's all arranged." "But how?" I asked. "A friend offered to help," he explained. I felt as if I had swallowed several frogs. They were hopping in my stomach. I was so happy. I started jumping too. I could finally give Caitlin something she had asked for after everything she had given me. The day my photo was taken, I wanted to look my best. I asked my father if I could wear his button-down shirt and his only jacket, even though both were too big on me. He agreed and then also pulled out a tie. I'd never seen him wear it before. It was beige with a brown swirled pattern. Wearing my father's clothes made me feel powerful and strong. We paid the photographer for 2 photos because you had to pay for the picture even if it came out badly. So if he chopped off your head, you still had to buy it. We took 2, hoping at least one would come out okay. One was blurry, but thankfully the other was fine. Part 2. Clues.
December 1998. Caitlin. I was surprised to get such a formal photo from Martin. All the pictures I had sent him of me with my friends were goofy by comparison. In his, Martin was wearing a suit that looked too big for him and was staring straight into the camera, looking quite serious. Still, I could see the sparkle in his eye and the hint of a smile on his lips. I immediately put the new photo under the piece of glass on my desk, next to the first one he sent. Looking at them side by side, I realized that we were growing up together, so far apart. It was strange because even though we had never met, Martin was the only person I felt I could be totally honest with. I never worried that he would judge or tease. On the contrary, I could tell Martin whatever was happening in my life, knowing he'd always take my side, no matter what. Even over the silliest stuff, like the time I saw Lauren hanging out with some older kids at the mall. I ran up to her and said, "Hey!" And she literally turned her back to me and continued her conversation as if I wasn't there. I can still hear her say, "As I was saying," while I just stood there growing hot from humiliation. That was in the middle of eighth grade. I described the entire incident to Martin, who responded in his very next letter, "That's so rude." Another time, I got into a really big fight with Lauren over a Janet Jackson CD. We were dancing in her basement with a bunch of our girlfriends, and somehow the CD got ruined. Lauren blamed me. I was so upset. I then thought, I have to tell Martin, and immediately felt better. He knew all about Lauren. I told him the whole story, ending with, "She's so mean." And Martin responded as if he totally understood, like he didn't know anything different, as if he was just like me. By then, he really was my true best friend. In hindsight, I'm almost ashamed of how ridiculous my teen dramas were. I had no idea what Martin was going through because he never let on. Instead, he responded to my silly stories and never said much about his own life. Not even when I asked him. But there were clues hidden in these upbeat, cheerful notes. Like the one he wrote me in November of that year. In addition to asking me if I had heard the new Spice Girls hit, Viva Forever, he also wrote, "At our school, we wear uniforms so our parents do not bother buying us as many clothes as you have. You are lucky." I think he was actually trying to protect me from knowing how incredibly hard his life was.
January 1999. Martin. Toward the end of 1998, things really began to disintegrate for my family. I was just about to finish Form 2, the equivalent of 8th grade in America. Nation and I began working after school as well as weekends in order to help feed our family. My father's paycheck was never enough. It was rough. Worse, I could see how it affected my father. He was no longer singing when he came home, if he came home at all. Some nights, he'd creep in late, well after we had all gone to sleep. I'd wake up, not from any noise, but from the sweet, rancid smell of chibuku. "How can you drink when there is no food for your children?" my mother would hiss at him the next morning. My father moaned through his hangover, but still got dressed and went to work. It was almost pointless by then. His paycheck barely covered our rent. My mother had begun working in neighbors' gardens and doing pickup work as a maid in town in exchange for mealy meal. At the end of the semester, I had to take an important exam, which cost $1 Zimbabwean. My friend Niasha came to pick me up the morning of the test. He had just moved to Chisamba Singles a few months before, and we became fast friends. He was smart and funny. We liked to study together. The morning of the test, I asked my dad for the dollar. He turned to my mom and said, "Give Martin the money." She was irate. "Are you crazy?" she shouted. "I don't have any money." Niasha was waiting right outside. He could hear everything. I was crushed. Then I heard Raymond and Paul arrive as well. "Martin, we're going to be late," Raymond shouted. I stepped outside as my parents continued arguing inside. My mind was reeling. If I didn't take this test, I couldn't move to the next grade. "I can't go," I said. "I don't have the fee." "You have to go," Paul said. "You're the best in class." I shrugged my shoulders and felt a warm sensation rise from my belly and get stuck in my throat. I did not want to cry in front of my friends. "I have an extra dollar," Niasha said. "My father gave it to me for good luck." He reached into his pocket and handed me the coin. "Are you sure?" I asked. "I'm totally sure," he said. "Just don't score higher than me." I did not bother telling my parents I had found the money. I just left, My friends came from poor families too, but they all had their dollars. Their parents knew it was important. The scores came back a few weeks later, and I once again received the highest grade in our school. I couldn't wait to tell Caitlin my news, but how? Postage to America now cost 14 Zim dollars, 2 weekends worth of tips, and my father could not afford $1 for a test. Around this same time, my parents learned that my younger brother Simba had started to beat up other kids to give him money or to bring extra food for him to school. He was only 7 years old, but that's how he dealt with his hunger. He was a bully. One day, all the parents came to school for a meeting. Many asked, "Who is this Simba Ganda?" That was because their kids would go home and complain about him. One girl begged her mom for 2 cookies every day. Her mother wanted to know why, and eventually she told the truth. She needed one for her and one for Simba. My parents were so upset. It was shameful not to be able to feed your kids. Plus, they did not expect Simba to go that far. We were getting sadza for breakfast, but it wasn't enough. And now the whole school knew, which was humiliating for my parents. Simba got a beating at home, which was rare. And then the teachers told my parents they had to feed him more, so my mom started giving him extra sadza every morning from the night before. But the problem was, other kids would have a piece of chicken or a muffin or peas, really sexy stuff. And Simba had sadza. So while he was no longer hungry, he still wasn't happy. I didn't mind the hunger as long as I could stay in school. In the past, if my father didn't have enough money to cover the fees, he'd borrow from neighbors or people at work and pay them back. He often used our boombox as collateral. We kept it on the same shelf with Caitlin's letters and used it to listen to music on holidays and weekends. I learned my father used it to get the money for the photographer when the man he borrowed it from came to collect his debt the day before Christmas. Since my father could not repay him, he took our stereo. That was a very sad day at our house. That boombox was a lifeline to a world beyond Chisamba singles. It was also my connection to Caitlin. When we played the radio, I'd hear songs that Caitlin wrote about in her letters. I felt like we were listening to them together. As the country became more troubled, my father stopped listening to music and singing. He was slowly just giving up. It was early January 1999 when I heard my parents fighting again right outside the house. It was in the middle of the night and I was lying on the floor beneath the thin blanket I shared with my brothers, pretending to sleep. Nation was on one side, Simba on the other. And though no one said a word, I knew they were both awake as well. I could feel the tension in their bodies, their hearts beating a bit more quickly than usual, but not as fast as mine. Baby George and Lois were fast asleep beneath my parents' bed. I was glad that they were too young to understand what was happening. My father shouted, "I don't have the money!" And my mother responded just as angrily, "Find it!" School fees were due at the start of every semester. My Form 3 began the following day. They argued until my dad stormed off into the night. I heard my mom enter the room. She stepped over us, her 3 eldest sons, and sat on her bed, which squeaked as she lay down. And then in the darkness, I heard what sounded like a gasp. I had never heard my mom cry before. The sound punctured my chest. I squeezed my eyes shut and stayed very still, trying to keep back my own tears. It was impossible. They started to leak from the corner of my eyes, and I prayed silently that my brothers would not notice. If they did, they never said a word. The following morning, my father was still gone. I got up, built the fire, and ate the leftover sadza my mother had saved from the night before. And then I went to school as if it were any other day. I walked into my classroom and took my seat at the desk in the front row with the others in my group. I didn't chat with my friends like I did most days. I quietly prayed that my teacher would overlook the fact my parents had not paid the fees. Instead, the headmaster arrived at the start of class and called out all the names of those students who had to leave. When he called my name, I felt a sharp stab in my throat. I wasn't embarrassed. Many names were called that morning. It was 550 Z dollars per student, roughly 20 American dollars, a fortune for many. Still, most of those kids didn't care about school. For me, it was painful to leave. As I gathered my things, my mind was racing. I had to get back to school as quickly as possible. I did not want to fall too far behind, as being the first in the class was my only way to go to university. Then another thought struck me. What would I tell Caitlin? And when would I be able to write her again?
February 1999. Caitlin. A month passed with no letter from Martin. I assumed he was busy with school. Or maybe there was another postal strike? Then, another month passed, and I started to get worried. What if he was getting bored of me? Or had found another pen pal? Still, I kept writing and checking the mailbox daily for a response. If there was no mail, I'd rush into the house thinking, maybe Mom grabbed it. She started shaking her head as soon as I entered, anticipating my broken record request. Every day that passed without contact started to hurt my feelings. Had I offended him? And then, one day in late March, my mom looked very serious. "Oh, honey," she said. "I just hope Martin is okay." "Why wouldn't he be?" I asked, my throat tightening. She told me she had been watching the news and that things in Zimbabwe were unstable. She mentioned that the economy was failing and food costs were skyrocketing. People were starving as a result. "Do you think Martin is..." I stopped myself. Too many terrible thoughts were filling my head. "He's fine," I said out loud, as if to assure myself. "He has to be." My mom sat on the couch in the den and patted the cushion. "Let's watch this together," she said. It was a BBC News special report on Zimbabwe that my mom had taped. Suddenly, terrifying images flashed before my eyes. There were riots in the streets. Soldiers were clubbing people. Gunfire sparked and crackled. Sirens blared. Small fires blazed as terrified people ran, leaving wounded or dead people behind them. It was chaos. The announcer mentioned international sanctions against Zimbabwe in response to the government's aid to Congo rebels. It was all over my head. Then, the most terrible thought struck me. What if Martin is dead? I fought back tears until I couldn't take it anymore. I ran up the stairs to my room and flung myself on my bed. As I sobbed into my pillow, soaking it with tears and snot, I realized how ridiculous I was being. My friend was in serious trouble. He needed my help. There was no time to act like a desperate teenager. I was totally fine, but I had to make sure Martin was too. And that meant finding him. I pulled myself together and went back downstairs to log on to AOL. I typed Zimbabwe into a search. Several articles popped up about severe inflation and how people were struggling to afford basic necessities like food. As I continued to read, I got more and more upset. There were riots in the street because people were literally starving. Poverty existed in the United States, but even most of the poorest people had access to food. Why had Martin never mentioned any of this? That night, I went into the den where my parents were watching TV.
"What's wrong, Caitlin?"
my dad asked.
"You look upset."
"We need to help Martin," I said.
"Caitlin, I know he means a lot to you," my mother started to say, but I cut her off.
"Can people actually die from hunger?" I asked. My sadness had turned into pure panic.
"What are you talking about?"
my father asked. My mom told my dad about the BBC News report and how we were concerned that Martin might be affected by the riots. I suddenly wondered if Martin had never shared any of this news to protect me. He knew I would want to do something to help, but I was so far away. What could I do? The next day, I didn't go to school. I told my mom I felt sick.
and that was true. Those BBC images kept me awake all night. I had a stomachache and felt nauseated as a result. What if he had been shot or was hurt in the riots? What if either was the reason he had not written? Or worse. That morning, I wrote yet another letter that said, "I'm really worried about you. Please write me back if you get this. I hope you got my last letter. I hope you are receiving my letters. And I hope you are not mad with me." I didn't mention the BBC news report, or that I had been researching Zimbabwe, or any of that. I wrote, "I'm praying for you." I was so distraught that I wanted to buy a plane ticket and go find him. But I didn't share any of this with my parents. I knew they wouldn't let me go, or even understand why I would want to.
April 1999. Martin. I was not the only student expelled from class that morning in January, but I felt the eyes of the students who stayed as I left, like wasp stings on my back. Nation was waiting for me outside. "Martin, it's not so bad," he said, throwing his arms around my neck. "More time to practice football." It was a bright, sunny day, but I felt cold in my bones and a big emptiness in my stomach. Nation sensed this. "You will be back soon, brother," he said. We walked home with a group of kids who had also been kicked out. Nation was laughing with them and dribbling the ball, which one of his friends had made out of plastic bags and string. No one else seemed too upset, but my mind was going a million miles a minute, trying to figure out how I could get back to school as quickly as possible. Form 3 was an important year. We had to start preparing for our O-level exams, which we took at the end of Form 4. They were your tickets to university. Without those exams, you could not go anywhere or do anything. I was so worried about all those missing lessons and tests. How would I catch up? Nation was not planning to go to university. He was a really good soccer player and wanted to try to make a career of it. I knew school was my only chance of getting a better life. I felt like I was moving backward. I knew my father wanted me to go back to school, but as inflation skyrocketed, we had less money to go around. How could I help my family, plus save up for school? It all felt so overwhelming. And then there was Caitlin, who sent a letter every few weeks. I had no way to respond. She also kept asking for more photos. I realized she didn't understand how impossible this was for me. It was my fault for not explaining it to her, but I didn't want her to know of my struggles. They seemed too low for her. I liked that she thought I was a kid, just like her. I also liked living vicariously through her letters. These days, it seemed ridiculous, as the life she described was becoming more and more of a fantasy. Trips to the mall, family vacations, and Friday night football games. She had all these exciting things to report. What could I write? Still, her letters kept me connected to this idea that things might improve, that there was a better life awaiting me. As we neared Chisamba Singles that morning, the empty feeling in my stomach grew. It wasn't hunger for food, but for a better life. I had no idea how to get there. So when Peter, one of the boys who had been kicked out as well, asked if I wanted to go to the market that same afternoon to work, I agreed. It was bad enough working weekends, but to be here on a school day felt wrong. I was competing with hundreds of people, each trying to make a buck. This type of pickup work automatically puts you in the lowest class. I had no choice. If I couldn't depend on my father, I'd have to make money myself. As Peter and I neared the market, I could smell the roasted peanuts and hear the rumble of the buses and shouts from people selling water, mangoes, and sadza as we crested a small hill. From the top, I could see the sprawl of people selling oranges, avocados, packets of nuts on brightly colored pieces of material, or small cardboard tables made from overturned boxes. Others sold live chickens, so there were crates piled as tall as a grown man filled with rustling feathers and frantic clucks. The market was encircled with idling buses and long lines of people waiting to go to Harare or Bulawayo, or to other countries like Mozambique, Botswana, or South Africa. Local routes also ran every hour to Mutare City Center, 30 minutes away. Those buses were always jam-packed with people. I knew from my weekend experience that the easiest way to make fast money was to carry luggage for passengers. If somebody had a heavy bag, you offered to take it to the bus. It was hard work. You had to climb on top of the bus, using the open windows as footholds, and then pull the bag up with you to place on the roof rack. I was excited when a man offered me $2 to carry his bags. After I lugged them through the market and heaved them up on the bus, he said, "Actually, I only have $1." That happened a few times that day. You could either take the bags back to where you first started carrying them or take the dollar. I figured that it was an extra dollar I didn't have before, but I was still angry about it. After 2 more jobs like this, I was exhausted. There was no shelter and the sun was blistering hot. The worst part of the job was jostling with other kids who were desperate like me. Together we formed a competitive gang. After my 3rd run, I was also famished. I wanted to buy something to eat, but that would take all the money I had just earned. So I kept working all day and felt let down when I came home with only 4 Zim dollars. I gave the money to my mom, who shook her head. Every little bit helped, but we both knew I'd never go back to school at this rate. Still, I was determined. Every day that week, I went to the market with Peter to wash cars and carry luggage. By Friday, I had earned 20 Zim dollars, 530 to go. My father asked about my day and could not look me in the eye when I reported my earnings. So I was surprised when he sat next to me at breakfast midway through my 2nd week working and said, "Martin, go to school today. Tell them I'll pay them next week." I felt a throb in my temples and my throat. The thought of going back to school was exhilarating, but I also knew they wouldn't take me without the full fee. Nevertheless, I felt a rush of excitement when I put on my uniform that morning and thought maybe, just maybe, they'd make an exception. My chest grew tight as I rehearsed my father's words on my way to school. Patrick spotted me and shouted, "Martin, you're back!" I waved and kept walking. I decided to go directly to my teacher, who was preparing for class when I knocked on the door. "Welcome back, Martin Ganda," he said, rising to greet me with a wide smile. I kept my eyes on the concrete floor as I relayed my father's promise. "Let's see what I can do," he responded. I looked up, unable to contain my enthusiasm. "Fantastic," I said. "I will do my best, I promise." "Martin," my teacher interrupted, "I already know what a dedicated student you are. I will try, but I cannot make any promises." The bell rang and kids started arriving in the classroom. I placed my hands together in a prayer position and bowed at him, our way of saying thanks in Shona. And then I took my seat, front row center. I spent that first class trying to concentrate on the lessons, wondering whom I should ask for the best notes to catch up for all the lectures I had missed. But then toward the end of that period, I saw the school's financial manager standing at the doorway. The teacher invited him in. I held my breath. The manager asked which students had returned to class. I was the only one that day, and so my teacher asked him to step outside for a moment. I said a silent prayer. The teacher returned with tight lips and a grim expression, followed by the financial manager, who came up to my desk and asked, "Did you pay your fees?" "No, sir," I started. My father said, before I could finish, he said, "Martin, I must see the paid receipts before you can enroll in class again. These are the school rules." The entire class remained quiet as I gathered my things to leave. No one was surprised my father could not pay. This was the story of too many people in Zimbabwe. Why did I think I was any different? As I left the room, I caught my teacher's eyes and bowed my head again. He nodded back, and I knew he was disappointed, though not nearly as disappointed as I. I returned to an empty home. My mother had gone to fetch water. That morning, a slow trickle of rusty red liquid came out of the communal faucet. It smelled of mud and left a residue on your skin rather than cleaned it. No one could bathe in it, let alone cook with or drink it. This happened frequently in Shisamba Singles. The nearest river was a kilometer away, but if the bed was dry or the water polluted, my mother might walk 3 or 10 kilometers to a place she heard from neighbors had a working well. It was still early in the day, so I changed from my uniform into my t-shirt and shorts and headed back to the market. There, a man asked me to help him pour tea, a new task. I did that for a few days, and while it was a nice change from carrying luggage, I made even less money. So I was intrigued when Peter asked me to help him sell cold drinks. It was a particularly hot day, and he had frozen these small packets of juice. He offered to split any profits we made after he was reimbursed for the cost of the drinks. I was excited, especially since by the day's end I had sold 2 boxes worth and had only a few juices left. The sun was casting an orange glow over the market as I headed toward a bus leaving for Harare. There were 3 and 4 people to each 2-person seat. I boarded, holding the box over my head, shouting, "Cold drinks! Cold drinks!" As I squeezed my way toward the back, I saw William, a friend from school, sitting with his brother laughing. William was in group 1 with me. He was clever and cared about school as much as I did. But he lived in a house, and both of his parents worked. He never had to worry about school fees or textbooks or money for exams. He had more than 1 uniform and several pairs of shoes. I suddenly felt hot, not from the crush of people, but from shame. I began walking backward, quickly. I didn't want him to see me doing this work, or knowing that I had gone that low. Even he knew that Zimbabwe was in terrible shape, but the people who lived in Chisamba Singles witnessed it every day. Food shortages had become a real problem. Fights broke out daily, haggling over prices or battering gone bad. This was becoming common, as was domestic violence. I had always heard men beat their wives since we lived in such close quarters, but now I would see it out in the streets as well. Nothing was being hidden anymore. AIDS, too, had become rampant. The man we split our room with had blisters all over his face as if someone had splashed him with acid. Another neighbor died from it that year. She got so skinny and weak that her family had to carry her outside on sunny days for fresh air. She looked like a skeleton draped with papery skin and scared me so much that I was relieved to hear she had died. I was only 15, but I knew Chisamba Singles was considered one of the worst slums, not only in Mutare, but also in all of Zimbabwe. We were famous for our poverty. If I had bumped into someone from Chisamba Singles on that bus, he would have understood why I was selling those drinks. William would too, but not in the same way. I gave Peter the remaining packets and walked home, feeling more down than ever, even though I had made $8 that day, a record. I still had such a long way to go. I felt doomed. That weekend, I got another letter from Caitlin. She had sent 3 in a row and was disappointed that I had not responded. I understood her frustration. Then I got to the part where she asked if I was mad at her. Mad? At her? This was impossible. I could never be mad at her. That she thought this made me so upset. I had to write her immediately. I had saved 32 Zim dollars and needed 16 for stamps, which would set me back from returning to school. But this was important. I still had to find something to write on. My dad was lucky to still have a job. Retrenchment had begun at the factory. They were firing older employees and hiring younger ones for less pay. I went back to the market the next day and kept my eyes open for something to write on. When I saw a young boy fling the wrapper from his ice cream bar onto the ground, I grabbed it without anyone noticing. It was still clean, except for a chocolate smear which I wiped off on my shorts. I ran home to write Caitlin. Since the paper was quite small, I compressed my handwriting to get as many words on the page as I could. This was a big moment in our relationship. I decided to tell Caitlin the truth about why I had not been in better touch. And I prayed that she would understand, and that she would still want to be my friend. The following day, I took my note to the post office along with extra money my mom gave me that morning to buy an envelope. I knew Caitlin's address by heart and wrote it in the center of the envelope, trying to leave enough space for all the stamps it needed to make it to my best friend's house.
May 1999. Caitlin. I continued to check the mail every single day for weeks. And then, one day, I saw an envelope so completely covered with stamps, it barely had space for my name and address. Martin was alive! I ripped it open, thrilled. But when I unfolded the actual letter, I gasped. My friend was writing to me on trash. As I read his small, cramped words explaining why he had disappeared, I felt a crazy mix of relieved and confused. He wrote that he had been kicked out of school because he didn't have enough money to pay the fees. This made no sense. Couldn't he switch to a public one? It was illegal in the United States to just not go to school. Wasn't it the same in Zimbabwe? I read the next line. I've been carrying luggage and pouring tea just to make money so my family can eat. The pressure that had been building in my chest left no room to breathe. He was a kid. He should be in school, not working to feed his family. Still, I was so relieved to get his letter that I ran into the house shouting, "Mom, Martin is alive! He's alive!" "Thank God," she said, rushing to my side. "Is he okay?" I tried to answer, but the tears that started in the driveway were now washing over my words. "What is it?" she asked, concerned. "He's not going to school," I managed to say, before another wave of tears took over. I sunk my head into my mother's soft shoulder. "Mom, he's pouring tea and carrying luggage to help feed his family." "Now, now," she said, rubbing my back. "Martin is a smart boy. He will find a way to get back in school, Caitlin." I tensed up. She had no idea what he was experiencing. I could barely grasp it. And as much as I wanted to believe her, I knew he could not do it on his own. I wanted to help, but how? I did not tell my mom any of these thoughts racing through my head. I did not want a lecture about how I needed to concentrate on my own life first, or about how Zimbabwe was not the United States. I knew that. I had been reading everything I could find online about President Mugabe and what a terrible monster he had become. How people were dying of hunger and disease as a result of his greed. It seemed so illogical, so wrong. I had been so worried about Martin for the last 2 months that I had stopped thinking about much else. My grades started slipping as a result. I had the luxury of not being interested in school, while Martin was actually unable to go. It seemed so unfair. "I have to study," I lied. I just wanted to be alone. Upstairs in my room, I pulled all of his letters out of my desk drawer, looking for clues that might help make sense of everything. All these lines I had glossed over before jumped out. High-density suburbs. 10 people per bed greatly increased my wardrobe. There were so many clues that he was struggling, but I never paid enough attention to figure them out until now. I felt like an idiot. Immediately, I pulled out a piece of stationery. The words gushed out of me. "Dear Martin, thank goodness you are okay. I was so worried. I thought something terrible happened to you. For some reason, I thought you may have drowned. I know that is crazy because Mutare is nowhere near the ocean or even a lake, but still, I had nightmares about it. I have been reading so much about what is happening in Zimbabwe, and so I am especially glad that you are not hurt. But I am so sorry that you are not in school. I don't understand it, and I cannot begin to imagine what that is like. Here in the United States, we have to go to school. It is the law. Everybody goes, regardless of how much money you have. Of course, there are kids who drop out or don't care, but I have never heard of someone who wants to go not being able to. I had so many questions for Martin, like, how can you get to go back to school? What are your parents doing for money? How are you paying to live? And why are you working to buy food for your family? But I didn't want to overwhelm him. What if he did not have any answers? It would just make him feel worse. Instead, I wanted to write something that might give him hope. And I wanted to do something to help, really help. That sparked a thought. I'd just earned $20 from babysitting, which I was planning to spend on silver hoop earrings. Martin needed the money way more than I needed another pair of stupid earrings. $20 couldn't possibly get him back into school, but maybe it could buy food for his family, or at least stamps and stationery so he didn't have to spend his money to correspond with me. I stuffed the bill into the envelope and wrote, "I am enclosing some money and hope it helps somehow. Your best friend, forever, Caitlin." The next morning, I handed my letter to my mom at breakfast and asked her to mail it that same day. I didn't tell her or my dad that I was sending Martin money. I didn't want them to tell me not to.
May 1999, Martin. After I sent the letter to Caitlin, I went to the market every day that week to make as much money as possible. It was the only way I could go back to school. Even if I missed the whole year, I'd catch up. That thought kept me going. The mailman arrived on his bicycle one Saturday as usual. When he shouted, "Martin Gander," I ran as fast as I could. I wanted to read Caitlin's note in private and walk to the outskirts of Shisamba Singles. I was so worried about how she would respond to my news. Would she think differently of me? That I was not worthy of her friendship? I hope not. But I was feeling so bad about my life at that point that I wouldn't have blamed her if she decided to stop our correspondence. I could barely afford to write her letters, and beyond that, I had nothing else to offer. I slid my finger beneath the envelope seal, admiring the high-quality paper she always used. It felt heavy and soft at the same time. When I pulled her letter out, I saw that she had stuck something inside. I thought it was another dollar bill, and my lungs inflated. Then I saw it wasn't $1, but a $20 bill. I felt as if I might lift off the ground like a hot air balloon. I examined it closely. President Jackson looked so regal. And those words, "In God we trust," that hovered over the White House made me giddy. When my mother and I had taken the dollar to the post office to exchange it, we had walked out with 24 Zim dollars. I did quick math. That meant $20 was worth at least 480 Zim dollars, enough to get me back in school. By now I knew inflation had doubled, which meant the US dollar was even stronger. I had to hold back from shouting in pure joy and relief. Before I ran to find my mother, I read Caitlin's letter to make sure she wasn't upset. I tucked the $20 bill in my pocket. People were stealing the most basic things in Shisamba Singles these days. $20 could get me beaten up and robbed, if not killed. I read Caitlin's friendly letter 3 times, looking for clues that she may be disappointed in me. I could not find one. On the contrary, it was clear that she only wanted to make sure I was okay. She didn't blame or judge me for being poor. Instead, she wrote, "I hope this $20 helps." I knew she was kind, but this generosity was totally unexpected. Caitlin's support felt godsend. I raced home and found my mother hanging clothes to dry on the wires, strung between our house and our neighbors. "My, I must show you something," I said. I didn't want to flash the cash out in the open. "Follow me." Once inside, I handed her the money.
"Where did you get this?" she asked.
"Caitlin," I said.
She studied it closely.
"But how can such a young girl afford this?" she asked. "And why would she send it to you?"
"My, Caitlin has a very big heart," I said. That was the only explanation I could come up with.
"Martin, this is enough to get you back in school," she said.
"I know," I said, and closed her hand around the bill. "Help me take care of it." She clasped her free hand around mine, sandwiching my fist between her small but strong fingers. Then she placed her forehead on mine and began to ululate, but softly. She broke free to dance in a small circle, and her joyous cries came out as throaty, high-pitched whispers. Like me, she did not want to attract anyone's attention to our good fortune. But also like me, she couldn't contain herself. "The post office in Sakuba is closed, but if we go now, We can get to the city bank in time, she said. It usually took over an hour to walk from Shisamba Singles to the center of Mutare, where several banks were located. We made it in less than 40 minutes as we were practically skipping. Nation was in his last year, Form 4. He wanted to finish up and then focus on a soccer career instead of trying for university. Depending on the rate, the money might help him as well. In the meantime, he was selling used clothes with a friend in the market to make money while not in school. It was better than carrying luggage, but he hoped it was not forever. We arrived at the bank and joined the queue with men in suits and women in skirts and blouses. Everyone wore shoes. My mother was barefoot, and I was wearing cheap flip-flops, my only shoes, which I had repaired with plastic bags fashioned into straps. We stood out among these city sophisticates in their sturdy lace-up shoes or good-looking pumps. But we had reason to be there too. When my mother placed $20 in front of the teller, he looked surprised, but didn't say a word as he counted the Zimbabwean bills not once but three times before placing them in an envelope. I was speechless too. It was 700 Zim dollars, as the new rate was 35 Zim dollars for $1. My mother placed the slim brick of cash beneath her skirt, tucked tight against her belly, and I followed her out, looking all around for any sign of trouble. No one ever would have guessed that the two of us would be carrying so much money. We were safe. We decided to take the bus home, since it was already mid-afternoon and we had the money to do so. We arrived at the market, where my mother used 6 Zim dollars to shop for sadza, beans and greens. When we passed the chicken stand on our way home, she stopped.
Martin, we have not been able to eat meat on Christmas for so many years, she said. Let's celebrate today, in honor of Caitlin.
My mouth began to water as she picked a plump chicken from the stacked crates. Everyone in our family knew the good news, but we ate silently, smiling. If a neighbor asked, we said the chicken was a gift from our uncle in Harare. We did not want word to spread through Shisamba Singles that our American friend was sending money in the mail. It would make us a target. Many people were complaining of robberies. Basic necessities like sadza and cooking oil were being stolen. My mother kept the actual money hidden from my father as well. He wanted a real beer to celebrate the news. Not Chibuku, but a glass bottle of Castle. Instead, he ate sadza and chicken and beans with his family. That Sunday was one of the longest days ever. I couldn't wait for Monday morning to march back to school and hand the money directly to the school busser. When I did, he smiled and said, "Welcome back, Martin." I had missed several months of school and exams were coming up, so I stayed after school for weeks to copy notes directly from the teacher's textbooks. And then one afternoon, instead of going home, I headed over to the Mutare Teachers College not far from my school. I knew there was a library on campus that had electricity, which meant I had light as well as tables to study at. The library closed at 7 p.m., but I quickly discovered a way to sneak back in after the guard made his last rounds. There was a large unlocked window at the back of the building that I could easily slip through. One night, I waited for the guard to leave, and then I found a rock to use as a step to hoist my body up and through the window's narrow opening. I landed, hands first, on the cool linoleum floor, surrounded by the quiet of books. I felt at peace for the first time in forever. Rather than let myself get lost in that feeling, I cracked open my mathematics textbook, which was like a jolt of caffeine. Seeing the numbers and problems dance before me was like greeting old friends. I was giddy as I dove into my work that night, and many more that followed. Within a month, I was back on track.
June 1999. Caitlin. After he sent the letter on the ice cream wrapper, Martin started to open up to me in a way that made me realize how different our lives were. Until that moment, I did not understand how truly privileged I was, and that was only the beginning. In the next letter, Martin wrote that the money I sent him got him back into school and fed his entire family a dinner he described as a feast. He said,
We ate chicken for the first time in many years. It felt like Christmas. I was stunned. We always had roast beef or turkey and ham for Christmas. In fact, there was such an abundance of food, we'd have leftovers for days. Chicken was a regular weekday night meal. If $20 could do so much, I wondered, what could 40 do? I was working as a camp counselor that summer, and my dad gave me $20 a week for chores I did around the house. They included picking up dog poop in the backyard and cleaning Lewis's cage. I also had to dust the living room baseboards and empty the dishwasher. I had also started babysitting every Wednesday afternoon for the woman who ran the summer day camp. She had 3 kids. From then on, whenever she asked me to work on weekends, I said yes. I slipped 2 $20 bills in my next letter and asked him to use some of it on postage. I had never worried about the price of stamps. I just handed my mom the letters I'd written and knew she'd take care of it. I didn't want Martin to worry about the cost of school, let alone buying stamps to write to me. It felt good sending him money to help with these things. He was the first person I had ever known who really needed my help. I wasn't going to let him down. Besides, I got to go to school for free, and my parents kept our refrigerator full. I certainly didn't need another piece of costume jewelry, or a candy-flavored lip gloss, or a new CD at the mall. I couldn't share any of these thoughts with my friends, though. They didn't, or couldn't, understand. I learned this the day after I got the ice cream wrapper note. I found Lauren and a few other friends hanging in front of our lockers before homeroom and blurted out, "Guess what? Martin is alive!" Lauren did an exaggerated eye roll before saying, "Jesus, Caitlin, enough about you and your African boyfriend." All the other girls giggled. "God, Lauren, how many times have I told you he's not my boyfriend?" I said. My blood felt like boiling lava coursing throughout my body. "Yeah, right," Lauren said to more laughter. "It's so obvious you're in love with him. Why don't you just fly to Zim wherever he lives to marry him and get it over with?" "That's gross," I spat. But Lauren had already started walking to her next class, gossiping with 2 other girls who followed her like panting puppy dogs, leaving me smoldering. One girl, Tina, stayed by my side. "Why are you so offended?" she asked tentatively, trying to be nice. "That's like telling me to go marry my own brother," I said. Tina looked at me like I was crazy, and then ran to catch up with Lauren and the others. "Screw them," I thought, as I threw my book bag in my locker. Nobody would ever understand my relationship with Martin, except for Martin. So I kept it to myself. It was easy to do. Martin had started sharing what his life was really like with me, which made all my friends' high dramas seem trivial. Strict parents, bad grades, or stupid boyfriends? My friends' complaints seemed so unimportant and meaningless compared to what Martin was experiencing. Mine did too. I started to look at my own life in a new way. I saw all the things I took for granted. Which cereal to eat for breakfast, or whether or not I wanted ice cream or cookies for dessert. These decisions were total luxuries. I got to choose. Even going to school felt different. Not so much this thing I had to do, something I was lucky to get to do. For almost 2 years now, I'd been so naive. I had assumed that Martin's life was like mine. I stopped writing to him about going to the mall with my friends or about my dumb friend dramas, and instead started pushing him for more details. I'd ask outright, "What do you need? What does your family need?" I also wrote, "I'm so glad you're back into school, but what about your siblings?" In my early correspondence, I was timid about asking such forthright questions because I didn't want him to think I was stupid for not already knowing. Now, I saw that it was my responsibility, as his friend, because his answers would help me make sure that he was going to be okay, no matter what.
Part 3. Generosity. June 1999. Martin. The postman didn't even have to call my name. I spotted the letter decorated as always with small hats and stars, Caitlin's trademark. This time, she sent two $20 bills. I was blown away, and still had no idea how she could afford it. But then I thought of the expensive t-shirts she had sent me, as well as the photos of her family's cars, plural. Even her dogs had beds and blankets. In my mind, she was very rich. And so I guess that money was not the big deal to Caitlin and her family that it was to me and mine. Meanwhile, I did not know anyone who could loan me 10 Zim dollars, let alone 40 American dollars. The timing was almost spooky, as the retrenchment at my father's work continued. Most of his friends had been replaced. These men were also fathers of families who depended on them, which was why my dad continued waking up every morning and walking the hour to his job as he had done for so many years, even though he was sure he was next to be let go. I admired his resilience then, and still do today. A lesser man may have been threatened by Caitlin's generosity. Here was a 14-year-old girl, sending us more money than my father made in several months. My father only had love and respect for Caitlin. Her letters had always been precious to me. Now they were also crucial to my whole family. We were on a ship that was sinking, huddled at the tip before it went under. Caitlin's gift was a lifeboat. My mother was afraid to keep this much money in our house. It made us a target in these difficult times. That same day, we set up a bank account at the post office. After so many years of relying on my father, my mother seemed happy to have some control. That July, my father's paycheck could not cover our rent for the first time. My mother used Caitlin's money to make up the difference. No one ever said what we all felt. What would we have done if it weren't for Caitlin? I didn't dwell on that thought. I was too focused on catching up at school. I had 9 classes. Mathematics, accounts, biology, computer science, and physical science were easy. So were English and history. I continued to struggle with Shona and now English literature. But by the end of the semester, my grades were once again the best in the class. This made my father very proud. He suggested I go stay with his brother in Harare during our winter break that August. My uncle's daughter had married a man who worked at a bank in the capital. They arranged for me to work at the bank as a T-boy. I had never been to Harare before, so I was extremely excited. I took the overnight bus from Mutare and wore my Reebok shirt for the trip. I wanted to look cool, not like a country boy. My uncle met me at the Harare bus station dressed in pleated pants, a button-down shirt, and sturdy leather slip-on shoes. I was so impressed. We went to his apartment, which he shared with another family. He had 2 wives who alternated visits, but mostly stayed in the rural areas. His first wife was only able to have 1 child, which was why he married again. He had another 3 children with his second wife, one of whom was married to the man I was going to work for. My uncle pointed to a corner in the living room where I could sleep, and then gave me detailed instructions on how to get to the bank to meet Alois, my cousin's husband. That was a great adventure. My uncle told me which bus to get on, where to get off, and then what building to enter. Thank goodness, I would have gotten lost otherwise. I'd never seen so many people or cars or such tall buildings in my life. Everything seemed faster and louder and brighter in Harare than in Mutare. My blood seemed to pump faster too, trying to keep up. Alois was even more put together than my uncle. He wore a suit and tie, like the managers at my father's work, but he was only in his mid-20s. He greeted me with a firm handshake and a broad smile, and then introduced me to several of his colleagues before taking me to the tea station. My job, he explained, was to make cups of coffee for every bank employee at 10 a.m., 1 p.m., and 4 p.m. If anyone requested a cup in between, I was to do that as well. I liked my new job. The people at the office were very friendly. After a week, I knew everyone's preferences, who liked it very sweet, who wanted more milk.
That first weekend, Alois and his wife, Sekai, invited me to go with them to their favorite cafe. Sekai was very pretty and funny as well. Her name in Shona means to laugh, and when she did, people wanted to join her.